following episode of Catch It, Cook It, and Eat It has been sponsored by the Hearst Ranch. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands on the central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, go to HearstRanch.com.
Fish heads, roly-poly fish heads, eat them up, yum. Fish heads, roly-poly fish heads, eat them up, yum.
Yo, welcome back to Catch It, Cook It, and Eat It. I am here with Rob Moss, who is a local New York hero, at least to me, and the fishing community. Rob was the first person to really document fully, extensively, the New York fishing scene. And I just want to say thanks for coming on the show.
Am I on?
Okay.
It's a great pleasure to be plugged in.
We just want to look at your face. We don't want you to talk, okay?
I pride myself at being very plugged in.
Yeah.
No, thank you for having me here.
So you did the first ever... God, that's not me, is it?
I thought I turned it off.
Remember? Man. This is an interesting start, and we're just going to let that go. So this is... Rob made a film called Gotham Fish Tales, which sort of documents maybe a handful of like the most diehard... fishermen in the New York area, and it was a huge undertaking, way more than you ever imagined. Is that right?
Well, it was a long undertaking. You know, I didn't know what I was getting into when I started it. Uh-huh. I was interested in fishing. I'd always fished, but not in the city.
Right.
You know, other places, and my sort of main gig is doing stills work. Okay. And I was doing a stills job for the city.
So you're not a filmmaker.
Well, I've become a filmmaker over the years, mm-hmm. Although more actively doing stills, but I really do like doing film a lot. Yeah. And it's so much more accessible to people these days, just to work with it and edit mm-hmm. it and so on. But mm-hmm. so what happened was I was doing the stills project for the Department of Environmental Protection, the City Department of Environmental Protection, mm-hmm. about wastewater treatment.
Okay.
And that had me traveling amongst the different wastewater treatment plants right. of the city, which are many. Okay. I think there are 16 of them.
Right.
It's a huge, very impressive system, actually.
Yeah.
Something you might want to look into another time. But as I was doing that, I was running across the employees of these treatment plants who were fishermen, and they were fishing on their lunch hours, or they were telling me about, you know, the good fishing around there. You think, well, on the one hand, you think, oh, you know, all this dirty water coming in here, but of course, it should go out. I mean, the water needs to go out clean.
Yep.
So, we have a little technical interruption here. I'm so sorry.
Don't worry about it.
So, but the point is...
You can take it if you want.
The point is...
if it's a fisherman.
That... the water, you know, comes in dirty and goes out clean.
Mm-hmm.
So when those guys were standing at the edge of these wastewater treatment plants, they were you know, fishing in clean water.
Yeah.
And they were catching fish. And, mm-hmm. and I like to fish. I thought, well, there's something here.
Mm.
And so I started in on it. And I thought, well, I don't want to do this story in stills with text. You need to see it. You need to see the setting and so on. So I just started right in on it without a real clue as to where it was going.
Okay. And you came to them and said, hey, how about a film as opposed to...
I started just, you know, doing research and looking for places and people and resources, you know, that would sort of begin to open up the story.
Right.
And it was sort of one of those classic situations where every situation or person opened up the door to somebody else.
Yep.
And it was very clear to me from pretty early on that this there was a lot to say.
Yeah.
A lot to show. And, you know, what got me going, amongst other things, was that I am a native New Yorker, and yet I didn't know a lot of this. So, mm-hmm. and I love New York history. I'm interested in New York, you know, in many respects. And so that alone, you know, was of interest to me. And it also appealed to the fact that most people didn't know that this was a very abundant resource.
Sure.
That people did not know about. And in addition to that, there's a curious dissociation from the water in New York. Although that has been changing in the last couple of years. Right. You know, you've got the Brooklyn Bridge Park opening up.
Right.
The West Side, the Hudson River Park, you know, it's kind of brought people back a little bit, and it's great.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, for a long time, there's been a dissociation.
Which is so strange, because in Boston, they pride themselves on being like this coastal community, and it's like their whole heritage and their whole... And New York has the same, if not even a stronger connection to the ocean and fish and all that, and yet they don't grok it.
They don't grok it, right?
No.
It's a huge disconnect, and yet it's... But the best example I always thought of was, you've got millions of people that every day drive over the water,
right,
the Verrazano and all the East River and Hudson River bridges,
mm-hmm,
or drive under the water and the tunnels, and don't give it a second thought.
Oh.
It's just an impediment to getting into Manhattan,
sure,
or back home.
Right.
They
never put their feet in the water around here.
No, no. Unless, you know, some people in Queens and Brooklyn, you know, use the Rockaways, use the beaches in Coney Island and so on. One of the best lines I ever heard about it was a good New Yorker writer, Ian Fraser, wrote about fishing in the East River. And he lived in Brooklyn, and he took the train over to the base of the Manhattan Bridge on the Manhattan side and fished. And he said it was the first time he ever traveled under the fish first before he caught them.
Yeah.
Which I thought was an interesting way to think about it.
I wish they would do what SeaWorld does in their little cafeteria, where they would make the tunnels glass. Not that you'd see anything, but it would be kind of cool.
Well, I know a diver guy who told me that sometimes you can get really good visibility. It really depends on the condition. I mean, we, you know, this is a tidal area. We've got two high and two low tides, depending on what's happening. I mean, you know, if I wanted to fish today, mm-hmm, which I actually thought about, I wouldn't, because there's all this stuff, all the stuff that's come out of this rainstorm.
Right.
Unbelievable.
And
I just thought I'd turn this off.
But you're, I mean, you live in the east side, right? Lower East Side now. What do you, where, what's convenient as far as fishing spots for you?
Well,
Like where would you go if you just wanted a quick trip?
Well, I sort of don't usually do it that way. I have a car.
Okay.
So I go places by car, which is not to say that you need a car. Now, a lot of people, you know, a certain number of people fish in the East River.
Mm-hmm.
They fish in the 20s. They fish in Chinatown area, near the piers of the bridges. Just last fall, the end of the fall, I started to fish a little bit on the Dumbo side of the Manhattan Bridge.
Okay.
And there were a lot of fish there.
Yeah.
That particular couple of times I went. Small schoolie bass.
So you prefer the Brooklyn side to the Manhattan side?
Well, I'm over there a lot. So, and I also like, you know, the Rockaways area, Jamaica Bay.
Yeah.
And
what about the ocean side of the Rockaways? Do you ever go out there?
Yeah. That can be really good.
Yeah.
Actually, that is one of the spots that, if you hit it right in the fall, can be phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, big
schools
of blitzing, bluefish, and bass
in
the fall.
I have this new technique, which is when the fish are just that little bit much too far out, and I can see them hitting the surface, and the terns are working, seagulls are working over them. I have a small rod, and I put it in my mouth, and I paddle out on a longboard. Oh, man, it makes the fishermen crazy on the pier.
Wow.
It's because they hate us anyways, because we're always in their lines.
Well, how do you cast when you're on the board? You're standing on the board?
Sitting.
You're sitting.
You can't cast far, but just far enough.
Well, that's like, you've heard about the skishers in Montauk.
Unbelievable.
These guys that go out in wetsuits, and they're floating around.
And they just kind of drift with the fish.
Yeah, I think it's a bit suicidal, if you ask me.
Can you explain that? Because I don't think most people know.
Well, skishers, they put wetsuits on. Mm-hmm. I think this was started in the Montauk area. And they take their rods and they go into the water.
Yeah.
And they, you know, the wetsuits are float, and they go out to get close to the fish, and then they sort of jump up to cast.
It's amazing.
And they catch a lot of them. What do you do when you have a 20 or 30 pound fish on, they'll and you're pulling around.
It'll just pull you. I mean,
they're pulling you, and I don't know how to deal with it. The people that do it, they love it, but yeah. I think they're insane.
This was invented, I think, after your film, so you probably would have featured them had you known about.
Well,
this, right?
I tell you one thing. I was I don't know of that existing in New York, yeah. Although it might. Okay. Which would probably be in the Rockaway area if it was anywhere.
You didn't want to feature guys all the way out in Montauk?
Absolutely not. I was just going to say, I was very religious about everything that's in that film is in the confines of the mm-hmm. city. Mm-hmm. And even there's one guy, Ronnie Ingold, who's no longer with us, but mm-hmm. he was the last shad fisherman below the George Washington Bridge, where there was a long tradition of many, many shad fishermen over the years. He was based in Edgewater, New Jersey, but I filmed him in the middle of the river where he had laid out shad nets.
Right.
And so I felt like that was okay. That was right across from the North River plant in Harlem.
Yeah, that was incredible. And also, I know, you know, I've had the Siemens on the show, and I know you featured them, and they're sort of like, a lot of these guys were the last of their kind.
Yeah, the Siemens are amazing people and just, you know, hold on with their fingernails. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think they have to supplement what they do by going out to Long Island because they can't even make a go of it just in the city.
Right.
Ingold is the last. Even things like there's a guy on the Marine Parkway Bridge, which officially is the Gil Hodges Bridge that goes out to the Rockaways, who you see three or four times. His name is Ronnie. And people can't fish anymore there because after 9/11 they shut down the fishing on the walkway. I mean, you can walk, you can bicycle, but you can't fish. I mean, the logic is beyond me.
Right. What do you think? You know, what's the future hold for commercial/recreational fishermen in New York? Because you know, I know all of a sudden last year out of nowhere they're like, well, now you need a license, and everybody was like, what's this for? What is this doing, this license? What do you think's going to happen?
Commercial, there's no commercial.
There's no future.
There is no... I mean, the Siemens who sell bait, they're just grandfathered in, basically. Yeah. There is nothing to sustain commercial fishing in the New York City area. Mm-hmm. Although, there are some lobstermen.
Okay.
And there are people that put out lobster pots even at the right under the Verrazano Bridge.
Gross. Remind me never to have a lobster at any Italian restaurant in Brooklyn.
There are also poachers, by the way. You know, they're definitely poaching stories, so you might get some of that. Huh. But and there have been some busts. I don't think there have been any in the last few years, but a few years back, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, there was some big busts of poachers. Yeah.
Wow.
But when you consider, I mean, look, there are two main breeding grounds for the striped bass, and that's the Chesapeake, which is the main one, and the Hudson River.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a huge number of fish coming in and
unbelievable amount of striped bass.
Yeah. So,
That hasn't always been the case, has it?
No, I mean, I'm not a historian of this, so I'm no expert. What happened with the striped bass, to maybe put it in a nutshell, is that in the early 70s, they discovered high levels of PCBs in the striped bass.
Mm-hmm.
And that came from the GE plants up in the north of Albany.
Okay.
So when they determined that these were dangerous levels, they shut it down completely. There was a commercial fishery of striped bass that they shut down.
Right.
And it's still shut down.
That they were catching within the river?
Yeah.
Yes. Amazing. Okay.
It was completely shut down and it's still shut down. Now, at the time, based on anecdotal stories that I know, the striped bass, recreational striped bass fishery was very bad because it had been overfished probably, and it just wasn't that good. Now all of a sudden, here's you got this huge breeding ground for this species, and there's no commercial pressure at all.
Right.
So over the years,
and a lot of guys releasing their fish too.
Yeah, I think that's a more recent development, maybe the last generation or even less, where there's a lot more awareness of that.
Mm-hmm.
But what it was then, and the recreational limit was one a day that had to be 36 inches.
Wow.
Now, 36 inches is a big fish.
That's a big fish.
That's a big fish.
In fact, that's a bigger fish than I caught maybe ever.
Yeah, that's a big fish. So even if you caught it, you couldn't legally keep it unless it was a minimum that size. I can't remember how many years ago they knocked it down to 28. It's 28 inches now.
Yeah.
Which is still a decent sized fish.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't think you'd get a 28 inch fish that was less than 7 or 8 pounds at least. So,
but what happened? I know you're a bluefish fanatic. Why is it that there are, at least this past year, there was way, way fewer bluefish to bass?
You know, I couldn't answer that. And okay. also, it depends on where you are. I mean, if you were going out in certain areas in the tin can grounds between the Rockaways and Staten Island, with people that target them a lot, they know where to find. There were a lot of them around.
Okay, but not up the river so much.
Yeah, I don't know. You mean up the river in the city or
East
further
River.
Up?
Well, I mean, I fish, you know, around Greenpoint.
Right.
No, I mean, we never got one.
And you previously would get them.
No, I this is sort of my first season where I was really hitting that area.
Right.
But I just thought, growing up, I was always used to catching, you know, a dozen bluefish and one bass. It was a special treat if you hooked a bass.
Right. I don't know why that happened. I didn't hear myself that there was a lack of bluefish around. So I really couldn't answer. I mean, you know, there's also weak fish, which we never get in great big numbers, but some years are better than others. Right.
Beautiful looking fish. Is it much to catch? Is it sort of a...
Well, they call it weak fish because the mouth is weak. Okay. So if you hook it, it's easy to pull the hook out. That's the sort of lure of it.
Huh.
You know, a weak fish is a sea run trout.
Huh.
And they're beautiful fish and they're really tasty fish.
Huh.
And if you catch one and it's keeper size, keep it.
And they're sizable. They get big.
They can get pretty big. It's unusual to catch a big one. Okay. I once caught a 14-pound one, which really surprised me, I have to say.
That's amazing.
I might go the rest of my life without catching one that big. Yeah, I was near the Verrazano Bridge on the Staten Island side. And that was a really delicious fish, too. Very moist.
Now, tell me, I think I'm really interested in some of the characters that you met in making the film, because I feel like you had special access to a crowd that most people, I mean, well, unless you jump in the right taxi cab, like, how did you first meet this Philip character?
Philip Frabasillo is sort of almost a legend, you know, and...
Do you know that we've pulled up some of his spark plugs?
You're kidding.
No. It was amazing. Last year, we pulled up some spark plugs. I was like, I know whose spark plugs those are. There can't be too many guys who fish with that setup.
As he says, three for the big sticks, one for the little stick.
This is just so you guys understand. This guy, he's a taxi cab driver. I'll let you tell the story. But we've pulled up his spark plugs, which he uses. He doesn't want to spend the money to go out and buy weights, sinkers. So he goes and ties a couple of car spark plugs together, Bosch spark plugs that are kicking around. And so we pulled up his rig like last year. And I was like, I know exactly whose rig that is.
Yeah, no, he's an amazing guy. He, you know, he's a cab driver, and he's also his own minister guy. Mm-hmm. So he does a lot of work at the missions and handing out food for the homeless and stuff like that.
Right.
So his cab is plastered with images of him with fish, of fish.
And is the rumor true that you can actually get a fish off of him? If he's,
I don't know.
You're not supposed to say.
He has food. He has so much gear in his trunk, you know, that sometimes if he picks up people at Kennedy, they have to put the suitcases on their laps, you know.
But I love it.
You know,
and like you see him, he's rigged up so he can do it really quickly.
Yeah.
10 fishing poles he can have out in like five minutes, not even.
Now, he wants to be able to, you know, squeeze in an hour here and there. He doesn't have time to mess around with his gear too much. I tell you, though, you know, if he's had some bunker, some bait in there for a couple of days, you'll smell it, too, when he opens up his trunk.
So he could randomly pick you up at any time, this guy.
He can, and he does. And, you know, the funny thing is, also, Philip, because he's prominent in my film, has always had DVDs that he'll sell to people out of his trunk, you know, or he has them next to him in the front seat.
Right.
And he has actually come by when he picked up people, like he's on his way to the airport and he's running short of films, and he's got two people sitting in the back seat on their way to the airport saying, I just have to stop for a minute and pick up some more DVDs.
Unbelievable. A little stop off. Your film was winner best documentary in Fort Myers Beach Film Festival, right?
Yeah.
It was the official selection of the Newport Beach Film Festival, and another one in Vermont, and then the broadcast premiere at the Sundance Channel.
Yeah. No, it got some good play.
It's huge.
You know, the challenge of the film was, I think, that you've got a sort of interesting subject that is unusual, And it's in New York City. And, you know, anything unusual in New York City catches people's attention. Right. My goal, as, you know, I kept filming, was number one, to get the species and the situations that I thought were important to get. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that took time. But then to tell people's stories in a way that you connected with it emotionally in certain ways, not just as a compilation of facts. Well, here you can catch flounder and there you can get albacore and wow, isn't that neat? Mm. But also, you know, people, real people and what it means to them. Sure. And I think that's why, you know, in some places people really took to it and said, yeah, this is an interesting story and they're interesting people and says something about people everywhere, you know. Right. So
such great characters. I mean, the my favorite thing was the banter between these guys was just unreal.
Yeah, you got a group of old men, for example, in that go to Canarsie Pier.
Those guys.
Yeah, that's in Jamaica Bay.
Yeah,
and it's like these retired guys or guys who have their days off that hang out. Old men,
and they're only there to get away from their wives.
Right, it's kind of like grumpy old men, you know, who hang out, and they sometimes catch a lot of fish. The herring can be in thick, you know, you'll catch three or four at a time, and they're BSing with each other and laughing at each other, and it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
Right.
Like one guy says, I asked him if he catches any gefilte fish, and he says, well, we usually pass over them.
I caught that. It passed over me the first time. The second time I caught it.
Yeah, he says, but they catch them in jars because they don't go for hooks.
Yeah, great characters. And then there was a guy out, he was catching flounder. He was on one of the bridges, I think on the way to the Rockaways.
Right, Ronnie. Yeah.
He's a character.
Well, he's one of the guys that I was mentioning before that you would never see anymore. This guy spent 6 months of his life fishing. He's a printer and he would, you know, print for a certain amount of the year and then fish. And you know, here you have got guys standing on a bridge, their cars buzzing by, their bicycles, you know, that are kind of dangerous, going fast down the pass. Uh-huh. And he says, you know what I like about this place is it's a great place to spend the summer.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean,
it's an excuse to hang out.
Yeah, he's got another great line where he introduces a guy who comes by. He goes, you know, I don't think he's from here. I think he's Porkajese.
Porkajese. He was a great. He's like fishing in this like sort of like fishnet tank top or something, as I remember. And he was he was just hilarious. And that guy fishes to the end. I mean, he won't stop.
No,
he'll catch as many fish as he possibly can. Right. That was
well. Yeah. I mean,
and then he gives them away, I guess.
Yeah, I did get. I did find examples, and I wanted to show examples. And again, this is sort of in the category of okay, you need to hit different subjects. So, you know, people want to know about overfishing or do they keep small fish and stuff like that. And you do find that. I didn't find it was so prevalent. It happens for sure.
Right.
I even went out with the DEC guys, the conservation guys who give people tickets for doing that to show that there is some enforcement. But it's very limited enforcement because there's a few guys and there's 500 miles of coastline.
And I also feel like most fishermen are sort of their own best self-governors. I mean, they take it seriously and they know the effects of keeping every fish you catch.
I think that, you know, fishermen and hunters, contrary to probably popular belief, are really good conservationists.
Yep.
Because, I mean, it's a generalization, but I think by and large it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the resource isn't healthy and continue to thrive, what they love to do disappears.
Yeah.
So it's in their interest that these things, you know, that the rules are kept.
Mm-hmm.
There's always going to be a bunch of jerks that
don't
do what they're supposed to do. But by and large, I think that people adhere to that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sports fishermen in the city, if they're more in there for the sport, people are hesitant to eat the fish.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
so tell me about that. On what's your take on, you know, how dangerous it is to eat fish out of
well,
New York waters?
First of all, I will make a disclaimer that I am no scientist or expert.
Okay.
So I don't take anything that I say seriously.
All right.
Having said that, you know, it's funny. You've got fish like a flounder or fluke that's a bottom feeder, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are no restrictions on them whatsoever. They're eating all the muck that's on the bottom.
Right.
Because of the way they metabolize what they eat.
Mm-hmm.
The top of the fish food chain, which is something like a bluefish or a striped bass, they have more fatty tissue in them, and that is what holes toxins.
Okay.
So if you caught a bluefish and there's that dark meat stuff, yep. you want to cut that out.
Okay.
Because that has more of whatever might be there.
Hmm.
But the state has recommendations which says you shouldn't eat more than one a week. If you're pregnant, you shouldn't eat them at all. But here's the thing. A lot of these fish, well, if you talk about striped bass and bluefish, they're migrating fish.
Right.
They don't live permanently one place or another.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, you can't interview them to say, well, how you been living here for a while?
How long have you been here?
Where did you come from?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, you can't know. And there are local populations of fish that stick around places. Okay. So you
Why
don't know.
Is it? That I don't understand. So how is it that there are some striped bass that are like, yeah, we're going to head down to Florida for the winter? And then there are others that are like, well, we're going to stick it out in the East River this season.
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I think it if you would ask people, they might say water temperature.
Mm-hmm.
They might say a source of food.
Is it the around. Bigger fish that are hardy enough to stay?
I don't think it's necessarily bigger fish at all. I mean, I think by and large, the stripers go into the ocean and they don't go as far south as Florida. They might go as far as the Carolinas.
Mm.
And then they start to move back now when they're going to be spawning.
Right.
I've been up the Hudson doing other things, filming other things where they're seining to see what's up there. It's mainly a lot trying to figure out about the shad, which have disappeared in great numbers, unfortunately, which was a huge fish for a long time in the history of this area, where you just catch so many big stripers in these nets, so many.
Huh.
And the shad... Not. I mean, you know, Washington's army in the Revolutionary War survived on the shad.
On shad.
When they were starving.
What are the theories as to what happened to them?
The shad? Again, you'll get a lot of different takes. I think I think there's a certain amount of overfishing. There are a certain amount of these kind of factory boats that take them in the ocean before they migrate and spawn.
Mm.
But I don't know
what
the answer is.
How did you, in featuring all these guys who clearly pride themselves on, you know, finding their secret spots. How did you get permission to film them without blowing out their spots?
Well, I didn't always get permission. So,
that's a filmmaker's trick, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just shoot and ask later.
Some of that, although I try not to do that because I respect the people.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, there were a number of situations where I had to go back a few times and not film, have my camera, maybe not have the camera, and just go there and talk to people about what I was doing and try to gain some confidence and trust before coming back.
And the fact that you're a fisherman must make a huge difference.
I know the issues. I know the lingo,
right.
You know, so, I mean, and it's clear if you care about something, people can see that.
Absolutely.
You can't BS, you know, whether you care about something like that. Somebody knows, we'll see right through it.
Right. So in addition to being a filmmaker, a still photographer, you're also as a home cook, a pretty serious fish cook, right? Tell me your best. What's your best way to do a striped bass or a bluefish?
Well, I do enjoy cooking a lot. Wouldn't make any claims about it, but I do. I mean, I've always said that on my epitaph, I'd like it to say, you know, he was always good for a warm meal. I like striped bass very much, number one. Mm. And one of the ways, let's see, that I really like to do is to take some soy sauce, add water to it, slowly cook it down to concentrate it, and then put some fillet, you know, cook some fillets in that with some garlic and some ginger, and top it off with a little fresh scallion or something like that. That's
Great.
Something that I really like. And I'm also a very big fan of eating bluefish any way possible.
Yeah.
You can make it even. I have a very.
New Yorkers don't like bluefish. It's strange.
You know, it's absurd. It's really absurd. You know, I would venture to say that most people that say they don't like bluefish have not really eaten bluefish.
Okay.
Or they've not eaten it fresh. Bluefish, you can't freeze.
I think that's the trick.
You got to eat it fresh. You don't have to eat it the day you catch it, but you got to eat it within a day or two.
Yep.
And be kept in good condition.
Yeah.
It's excellent. And people say it's fishy. It's not fishy.
Right.
One thing I like, I'll tell you one bluefish thing that's really amazing. Mm. And a chef in a Manhattan restaurant made it once, and I got the recipe from him, a ceviche.
Okay.
Where you're using lime juice, red and yellow peppers, olive oil, some hot chilies,
mm-hmm.
And it can be in that, you slice the bluefish very thin, and it can be in that mixture for as short as half an hour.
Wow.
And it's ready to eat.
Wow.
And it's really, really good.
That's amazing to me how the citrus, you know, cooks. Yeah. It's so fast.
It's amazing. Yeah. And the first time I had it, which was, it was probably a 12-pound bluefish, mm-hmm. which a lot of people wouldn't even eat.
Mm-hmm.
People have this thing also, which I totally disagree with too, and I've experienced it over and over, where they don't want to eat a large bluefish.
Big fish,
which
yeah.
they say, you know, tastes like a spare tire.
True of lobsters, though.
Is it?
Ugh. Like, you know, a big 8 or 9 pound lobster starts getting really gross.
Really? I've never seen an 8 or 9 pound lobster.
Leathery.
Yeah. Well, you've probably eaten more New York lobsters than you know about.
I'm sure you're right. But as far as the fish go, you don't think that size plays into their texture, taste?
Well, whatever? I know with people, size matters.
Yeah. A rude guy, this filmmaker we have on the show here.
I really don't think as much. I mean, I'm not sure that I would eat how good a 35 or 40 pound bass would taste.
Yeah.
But I would certainly eat a 20 or a 25 pound. I don't know, though. I don't know for sure. I think that's a little bit overdone about large fish. But I know that, for example, if you eat snappers or really small bluefish,
love them.
They're fantastic.
Love them.
They're mild. They're very good. They taste a little different.
How do you prepare those guys?
Well, first of all, I almost always fillet a bluefish, and I take the skin off.
Even a little guy.
Even a little guy. I don't want to deal with scaling anything.
Okay.
I don't like to scale fish.
Right.
And usually I'll fry them up. I like to eat them. You know, if they're small, with eggs.
Okay.
You know, I do that with mackerel too, but not around here. There used to be more mackerel around.
What do you mean with eggs? As your batter?
Fry it up. No. I'm talking about almost like a breakfast food. I see a lot of my fishing I do early in the morning.
Oh, like an omelet type of thing.
No, or I'll just fry up a couple eggs and fry up these, you know, fillets of fish and eat fish and eggs.
No kidding.
Huh. I like that a lot.
Huh.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And what do you use for your batter?
You know, I'm pretty simple with it. I usually use the Italian style or Italian flavored breadcrumbs.
Not the plain.
I don't like the plain. The plain's okay.
So you go with the seasoning, the Italian seasoning.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a whole lot.
This is your Brooklyn spin on cooking fish.
No, it's cool. I mean, sometimes I do other things. Sometimes flour, cornmeal.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but fresh fish is just great to eat no matter. You're just always going to have a good meal if you have fresh fish.
Right.
I've just been reading, by the way, this is something a little bit extraneous, but also related. You know, the oysters in New York City were known around the world when they were abundant. It was such a good place for it. And this never made it to the film, but I did film them dumping 10,000 pounds of oyster shells by the Statue of Liberty.
To try and create the beds.
Yeah, because the oysters really want to be on old oyster shell they call kulch.
Yeah.
And there are oysters growing in the harbor, but an oyster is a harbinger for clean water, because an oyster has to have clean water. They have total filter feeders.
Yeah.
But for example, and you probably remember in the film, their clamor is off of Staten Island.
Mm-hmm.
There are millions of clams here.
They still call themselves, up in City Island, clam. What is it? Clam suckers.
Oh, really?
And they call the tourists, or maybe they're clam diggers, but they call the tourists oysters. Oh, yeah, that's it. And then the locals are like mussel suckers.
Well, there are a lot. I mean, the clams that are, you know, you may well eat New York City clams in New York restaurants, but what they do is, and this is regulated, they harvest them, and what they did, which was very smart years ago, is they had a state law passed that outlawed any kind of using hydraulic winches and stuff to pull in the clam rakes, because then you're just going to fish it out really fast. So it's a hand operation
all the fishermen have hunchbacks now, but that's cool.
Oh, my God. I mean, 16-foot long poles and clam rakes. It's backbreaking work. Yeah, it really is. But you've got probably between 50 and 100 people that make a living harvesting clams. And so they put the clams in these 50-pound sacks. They put them on trucks. and they ship them out to the east end of Long Island. They put them back in the water in Gardner's Bay, so they're filtering very clean water through them for about, I think, 2 weeks maybe.
Okay.
And then they're confident that everything is cool, and they ship them back.
No kidding. Yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to wrap up pretty soon, but I wanted to, I want to know your take on sort of the, are we going in a good direction? Fish, water quality, because I'll tell you my angle. My angle is that people are fishing more than they used to. They're using the waters again more than they used to. I mean, my friends and I, we're down on the East River, you know, up to our waists now on a regular basis. And we're fishing and we're hanging out there. And I feel like that attention, if nothing else, just the fact that there are people doing this could be a good thing for New York, its fish populations. What's your spin on it?
Well, I think I agree with you. I think that, you know, in the same way that we just talked about hunters and fishermen, mm-hmm. I think when people are aware, let's put it in a larger context. As we were talking about earlier, that New Yorkers were very much divorced mm-hmm. from the coastline.
Yeah.
And there are over 500 miles of coastline in New York. This mm-hmm. is a coastal city. Mm-hmm. But most people here do not think of it that way, as a water city, because it was very important in the city's history, shipping and all this other stuff, and it changed. The more people become aware of the resource that is there, I think the better steward of the environment and the resource they become. Mm-hmm. It becomes in their interest to make sure that the quality of the water and what lives in the water and what access you have to the water is well maintained. I think people are smart enough to see that. The fact that the water, and the air for that matter, is much better than it was a generation and a half ago is because we had something called the Clean Water Act right. and the Clean Air Act.
Right.
These were federal laws that mandated that major initiatives had to take place. I mean, before the Clean Water Act, you had sewage being dumped directly into the city water system totally. All over the city.
Now, what about the rain that we just had?
Oh.
Because I read these articles about the fact that our waste treatment plants just can't, at a certain point, they just can't take all the water that's coming in.
That is absolutely true.
So they just dump it.
It's a problem all over the country, and yeah. it's called the CSO, the Combined Sewage Overflow. Mm-hmm. And what that means is when you have big rain events like mm-hmm. we've just had, the stuff that's in the pipes that is coming from toilets and everywhere else, yeah. that's going to the treatment plants. Right. But all the stuff that goes in the gutter, they'll cut off because the plants cannot handle everything. So what's happening is that everything is running off the street into mm-hmm. those gutters, are cut off from the plants mm-hmm. when you have major amounts of rain, and that's going directly into the system.
Right.
And that's bad.
That's bad.
But
especially because I'm surfing, right, where they dump it. Man.
Well, what you want to do is you don't want to fish, you don't yeah. want to swim, you don't want to surf mm-hmm. for a good 24 hours after a major water event like that. Yeah. You want a couple of tides to come in and out and pull that stuff out. Now, thankfully, the big water systems have an amazing power of rejuvenation in mm-hmm. them. I don't really know why. I mean, but it takes vigilance. And I think that the more people are aware of the issues that surround it, the better they'll be. I mean, we've become more responsible
right.
about it. We know we don't have an unlimited resource of anything.
Right.
So I think it's a positive message. I really do.
Good. All right, guys. Unfortunately, we are way over time here. And Rob, thank you so much for
my pleasure.
Sticking it out. I think we could have gone on for another hour.
but when we go off air, I'll give you a spot or two to check out.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for coming on the show. You heard it here. Catch it, cook it, and eat it. Justice, yeah, a city.